It's More Money with leading economist Steve Moore.
Stephen Moore is with us, economist.
With more than 30 years' experience as an economist and as a leading thinker of government on business, showing deep understanding of the shifts in the global economy. He's leading economist Steve Moore with More Money on Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's your host, Steve Moore.
Hello, everybody. Happy Easter weekend. I hope everyone is having a happy and holy weekend. And be sure to get outside and enjoy the beautiful day all around the East Coast. And we also have listeners in California. So I hope you're enjoying the great, great weekend as well. I call this, by the way, Resurrection Weekend, because not only is this Easter Sunday, but we had amazing news on the economy yesterday, which showed a blockbuster jobs number. Ladies and gentlemen, this economy is being resurrected. We are seeing big, big increases in job numbers. We're seeing the economy come back. Manufacturing numbers look good. Construction numbers look good. Housing looks good. I say the economy is right on a straight path to high growth in the second half of this year. And I'm going to give a nod to both presidents. I'm going to give a nod to, obviously, Donald Trump for Operation Warp Speed, which has been one of the most miraculous programs in American history. In terms of getting this vaccine done in less than a year, it took us about 9 months. As I've said many times on the show, it usually takes 2 or 3 years to get a vaccine like this. Operation Warp Speed worked like a charm. It probably worldwide will end up saving millions and millions of lives and potentially hundreds of thousands of lives here in the United States. We had a great vaccination distribution program in place, and I have to give some credit to Joe Biden. I think he's done a good job of getting the vaccines out there and continuing on the tails of what was started under Donald Trump. So this is fantastic news. I've said it week after week after week on More Money. And by the way, I want to thank you all again for listening in and letting me spend some of your Easter weekend listening to this great show. But, you know, it's really an amazing accomplishment when you think about it, that this was led by the United States of America. We are always the country that comes up with the great inventions and the great cures. And it's another example of why we are truly the greatest country in the history of this planet. I don't care what people say. I reject the idea we're systemically racist or that we have all these terrible problems in our past. No country is perfect and no group of people are perfect. But we are certainly the leader of the world when it comes to saving lives and new technologies and new patents and new inventions and new companies. And so it makes you proud to be an American, doesn't it, folks? It makes you proud to be an American. Today, I have a great show lined up. We have two great guests coming up to talk about what the future is for the economy. So I'm really quite excited about that. And we're going to talk a little bit about politics and what's going on with the Democratic Party. And I've got to say, linking to what we were just talking about, the big improvement of the economy, I'm going to say this loud and clear. We do not need massive new government spending. I'm going to give you these numbers, and I think they will blow you away. I hope they will maybe even depress you and maybe even get you. It's a call for action, what's happening in Washington right now on the fiscal side with our spending and our tax policy and our debt policy. And I don't care if we're Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative. This is out of control, folks. So we had $1 trillion already in the pipeline from the last COVID relief bill we passed in the final weeks of the Trump administration. So that was $1 trillion that would be spent over this year. And $1 trillion is a lot of money, folks. Don't forget, $1 trillion is $1 million. So it's an awesome amount of firepower we threw at this with respect to the money that has already been allocated. Then, as you all know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, Congress passed another $1.9 trillion. So I'm going to round that up to $2 trillion. So $1 trillion already in the pipeline, $2 trillion that was passed 3 weeks ago. And this week now, we've got Joe Biden saying he wants to spend another $2 trillion on so-called infrastructure. By the way, I don't think the federal government should be involved in infrastructure, frankly. Most of the infrastructure in this country is actually provided by the private sector, private businesses and private companies. And most of the rest is and should be allocated by local governments and state governments, not the federal government. The people who use these roads and the highways and the transit systems and the waterways and the sewer systems and so on, should be the people who pay for it. And so that's $2 trillion for that. By the way, it's also a huge Green New Deal program with massive amounts of money that would be spent on solar panels, on windmills, on electric batteries, electric vehicles. Incidentally, I have nothing against wind power or solar power or electric vehicles. I think it's a great idea. I just don't think the federal government has to spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars subsidizing these. And by the way, folks, do you all remember a company called Solyndra? For those of you who follow this stuff closely, you may recall Solyndra was a major solar company that got a massive $550 million loan from the Obama administration some 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. And this was supposed to be the great new solar company, and it was going to resurrect our energy industry, and we're going to see all sorts of new electricity supplied by this. And it turned out Solyndra went bankrupt just a couple of years after we gave them a $550 million loan guarantee. That means that you and I paid for it. Solyndra never produced a single kilowatt of electricity. There was money just down the drain. And the people who started the company, who had their connections in Washington in the swamp, they walked away with $500 million in their pockets. It was a swindle, folks. It was a swindle. And there were dozens of examples like that of companies that we subsidize. I'm against corporate welfare, by the way. I think corporate welfare is a terrible thing. I don't think the federal government should be giving money to companies, but we did it. It didn't work in 2009 under Obama. And I'm here to tell you, it's not going to work very well this year either with respect to all of the spending. Now, there's another $2 trillion spending bill that is coming down the pike that will be with us, that will be announced, I believe, next week or the week after, which is for what they call social infrastructure, which is for more education spending, more child care funding, more Medicaid, more health care, all of these social services. And folks, how is that infrastructure? You know, how is that infrastructure? That's just welfare and entitlement programs, which in some ways have a justification. But my goodness, count this up: $2 trillion for social infrastructure, $2 trillion for the physical infrastructure, $2 trillion for COVID, plus the $1 trillion that we already passed. So I'm going to do the math here: 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 1. That's $7 trillion. Folks, we are on a path to bankrupting our country. I think it's outrageous. I think we should stop the spending. Let's pay our bills. Let's make sure we're not becoming captive to China, because, as you know, China buys a lot of our bonds. And by the way, what happens if China stops buying trillions of dollars of our bonds? Who's going to buy them, folks? Who's going to buy them if China doesn't? So I'm very nervous about this. I'm here to tell you, we don't need the spending. We got an economy on repair. And the biggest danger is the huge tax increase that is coming. So in about 30 minutes, I want you to stay with us for this full hour if you can, because in about 30 minutes, I want to take your calls. It's the favorite time of my week when I hear from you. I don't care if you're a liberal or conservative or whatever your ideology. I don't care if you agree with me or disagree with me. This is a free speech station. This is a free speech show. We want to hear your opinion because you're the Americans who vote and make the decision. This is your country. This is your radio show. And so stay with us. And I'm going to give you that more hotline. Again, by the way, you're listening to WABC Talk Radio. And the more hotline is 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say that again. 1-800-848-WABC. It's the more hotline. Don't call now. Wait about 15, 20 minutes, and we're going to get as many of your calls as we can. Stay tuned. We will be right back. You're listening to More Money.
This is More Money with economist Steve Moore. Now, Steve Moore.
folks. Welcome back. This is Steve Moore. You're listening to our show, More Money, on WABC. And I want to inform you, by the way, that our new time on Saturdays is 2 o'clock. So we will be with you every Saturday at 2 p.m. And I am so honored to be able to speak to you every week. And I hope you can adapt to this new time and take a little time on your weekend and continue to listen to our show. Now, I was talking before the break about this massive amount of spending and a massive amount of taxing and borrowing that this administration wants to do. I think it's a big mistake. My next guest is Kevin Warsh, who is probably the smartest guy in America, and I'm not exaggerating, folks, when it comes to our monetary system in America. Kevin Warsh served on the Federal Reserve Board, which is one of the most prestigious positions in America, controlling trillions of dollars of the money that we create in this country. And Kevin, I believe, should and will someday be the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, because there's nobody who has greater insights about our economy and our monetary system than Kevin Warsh. So, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much. Happy to join the show and appreciate the kind introduction.
So let's get right into it, Kevin. I was saying before the break that I am extremely concerned about the amount of money the United States government is borrowing. I never thought I would see the day where we would be borrowing so many trillions of dollars. I count as much as $7 trillion of spending that the Biden administration wants to do right out of the gate with the infrastructure, the welfare programs, the COVID relief, and the Green New Deal. And I get asked this every weekend, Kevin, so I'm just going to shoot it over to you. If we go forward with this program, will there be an inflationary impact? Because we see some little whiffs of inflation right now, but not a lot. But I'm worried about it. Should I be?
So in a word, yes, it's a risk, and I think it's a risk that most of the policymakers in Washington are not taking seriously enough. The reason why I say it's a risk rather than we're sure it's going to happen is, Steve, as you and your listeners know, we've never run this radical of an experiment. This is in some ways an experiment which is the reverse of 1981 and 1982. In this version of it, how can we spend more? How can our government take more control of the private sector? How can the central bank buy more of the debt that's coming from another part of the government? And how can we fundamentally change the rules of the road of our economy? So I think any of us should be very humble about what we think happens here. But I think inflation risks are very serious. In some sense, Steve, what we might ask ourselves is if we are running a set of policies that are unsustainable, that in the old-fashioned language, Steve, you and I would say we're running a boom and bust economy. We've used the excuse of the pandemic to run a boom in asset prices, a boom in government spending, a boom in government power. Does the bust happen before we get a higher level of prices across the economy, or is there a bust such that we get lower level of prices across the economy? So I'm very humble about it, and the thing that worries me most, I heard a bit of your discussion before the commercial break, the thing that worries me most is the rest of the world is really quite disinterested with this radical policy we're having. Normally, when the United States does something that is massive and consequential in economic policy, the rest of the world joins us. In the 08-09 crisis, when I was in Washington, we ran some very aggressive policies to respond to the shock of 08, and the other big countries within an hour, a day, or a week were right there. What's amazing this time, Steve, is they're not there. Everyone else is just watching from afar with their mouths agape at this policy. And you made reference to the Chinese. The Chinese have stopped buying our debt. They've decided to stop participating in any large part in our auctions. So the rest of the world is watching this experiment, and we should be humble about what we think happens here instead of as complacent as I hear from many people in Washington.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that this is an experiment that we've never really seen the likes of. And you're also right, Kevin, that normally when we engage in an economic experiment, because we are the world economic global superpower, that the rest of the world tends to follow suit. And I've always said that, you know, America's greatest influence in the world is leading by example. But this is a case where I hope we're not leading by example, because I think what we're doing right now is so wrong. You know, the massive increases in the taxes, which are coming on top of the massive spending and borrowing. And by the way, I was talking to our mutual buddy, Larry Kudlow, earlier today, and he was noting that some of these other countries are actually cutting their taxes now. I mean, you mentioned even France cutting taxes. So that's I'm actually hearkened by that, the fact that the rest of the world isn't going over the cliff with us. Why is it that we're not seeing in any of the kind of normal forward indicators of inflation? We're just not seeing it. I mean, commodity prices, I've always liked to look at where commodity prices are as kind of one of my favorite lead indicators where inflation is headed. They spiked up a little bit. And by the way, they have risen from half after plummeting during the start of the pandemic, but they're not historically high right now. So I'm just confused by that, Kevin. Can you straighten me out? And even the tip spread is not showing a lot of inflation, even as these new calls for massive spending and borrowing rise.
Right. So I'd say there's a couple of good explanations, I think, for that. One is, for good reasons or bad, over the last decade, our government has decided to cancel price signals, cancel what financial markets can do to inform policymakers about what's next. So in the good old days, we would look in the treasury markets, we'd look in the stock markets, we'd look at commodity prices, and we'd say, what's that telling us about what's happening in the economy over the hill or around the corner? But look at the treasury markets, as for example, it's just a mirror image. It's not telling us much because, well, the Treasury Department is issuing new debt at a higher rate than at any period since World War II. The Federal Reserve now is buying about a quarter of all these auctions. So I'd say part of the reason why we don't see it in markets is markets are not acting independent of the government. They're reflecting it. So that's point one. I'd say second, markets are having a hard time distinguishing the cyclical from the secular. So right now, in some ways, the biggest stimulus that this economy is seeing is the vaccine. The vaccine is of order of magnitude more important to this economy than all those spending increases that Congress is passing that you referenced at the outset.
I think you're right.
And so that power of that vaccine is sending one direction, which is a really positive, healthy thing for our society and for our economy. And then some of this stimulus, which is far less effective, is hitting there too. So markets are trying to make sense of an economy in transition. We're seeing commodities that have moved up. They're off their highs, but the move in the last 12 months is certainly something that would get your attention, mine and our friend Larry Kudlow. Five-year forward inflation expectations, just a measure of inflation in the bond market, even though it's a bit repressed, it's the highest levels it's been over the course of the last several years. And I'll just say one last piece, which is inflation is a phenomena that I remember from my youth, sitting in my mom's big long station wagon waiting for gas, as it was our number to fill up for gas that day. To most people that are participating in these financial markets, they've never seen inflation. They've never witnessed it. They've never felt it. Yeah. And so what that tells me is they're not going to see it and feel it until they do, and then the move can be nonlinear. The move can be striking.
Right.
So again, this isn't to offer any sort of guarantee, but our friends at the Federal Reserve should be asking themselves with great curiosity, what's the source of inflation? Where does it come from? Instead of just assuming the next couple of years are going to be like the last 30.
Well, it's funny when you mentioned, you know, sitting in the waiting for gasoline with your parents. My first job when I was about 17 years old was working in a corner grocery store. And this was in the late 1970s. And I do remember inflation, Kevin, because this was back before they had the codes on the, you know, cans of vegetables and the cereal boxes. So we used to take those little sticker machines and we'd have to put the price on everything. And every few days I'd come in and my boss would say, hey, we got to put higher prices on things. And you see stickers on top of stickers with higher prices, because that was when we had, you know, 10 or 11%. And I think a lot of younger people from the, you know, the millennials, they've never experienced anything like that. So what about the dollar? How is that holding up under this?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, and the dollar is an important indicator to guys like you and me. So the dollar really was quite weak for most of last year, but for most of 2021, the dollar's been pretty strong relative to the other big currencies. So if you wanted to be a policymaker in the Biden administration, you'd say, oh, that's a voice of confidence in everything that we're doing, and these programs are going to work well. I think that'd be a very premature reading of things. I think the reason why the dollar is doing well is, frankly, because the creation of the vaccine and distribution of the vaccine is working better in the United States than in almost all of our trading partners. And so the relative growth of the U.S. in the next 6 to 9 or 12 months is going to be at the strongest rate that we've had since in most periods since the early 80s and by some standards since World War II, whereas Europe is still going to be in a period of very sluggish growth. Japan is going to be in a period of rather sluggish growth. So if the dollar is anything, Steve, it's a relative currency, and the relative move in the next 6 to 9 months for the U.S. looks fine. But what concerns the likes of you and me and what should concern your listeners is what happens next, what's over the horizon. And this kind of how do we juice the economy more in the next 3 or 4 quarters, this is dangerous policy because what people need to do to plan for their family's future is, well, what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years, not what's going to happen, you know, tomorrow.
And what will happen? So the question, I have two, you know, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you a couple quick final questions. Number one, I always get asked on this show about gold, and I've told people they should own some gold in their portfolios. But what do you think? Do you think that the gold is something that people should be holding on to? It hasn't done much. We haven't seen much change in gold prices.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll say this just briefly. Betting against the United States since 1981 or 1982 has been a bad bet. So betting for an alternative to the dollar in the U.S. has almost always been tough to do. But if, in fact, our government is making it a promise that they're going to change the policies of the last 40 years, the world's investors will, in that scenario, if this turns out to be a new regime for the next decade, the world's investors will look for something besides what they've been in, the dollar and dollar-denominated securities like treasuries. And so gold can fit well in that, but you know, so can, if you're under 40, the version of gold you care about is digital gold, something like Bitcoin. So these alternative assets have done quite well, and I'm afraid that our biggest competitor over the next couple of decades, China, they're trying to create an alternative to the U.S. dollar, and it's not gold. It's their version of treasuries in China, and those are yielding more, and so they're trying to get the world's incremental capital to flow into their country, which is something that's quite antithetical to what the likes of you and I and our viewers should care about.
You just said something very interesting that I had not heard before, which is this idea, if I heard you correctly, that maybe these cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are the new gold. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, if Bitcoin never existed, and I were to ask you the question, where would gold be trading today? I believe gold would be trading considerably higher than the $1,760 bucks it is right now. So part of the bid for gold, we all buy gold. Different people buy gold for different reasons. But part of that marginal purchase for gold is going to the next generations of gold. Now, it only has a 10 or 11-year history, not a 5,000-year history. But I think that the gold market's in some sense been bifurcated between whether you're over 40 or under 40. And if you're under 40, you're buying your new generation of gold. And I don't know whether it'll be around for the next 5,000 years. But 11 years is different than where it was 5 or 6 years ago. And the longer it survives, the more it's competing with gold as that alternative.
So one last question on the way out. Larry Lindsey, our mutual friend, was on Fox yesterday, and he was saying that he thinks that he is worried a little bit more maybe than you and I are about inflation. And he was saying that the 10-year treasury will be up to 3% in a year from now. Do you agree or disagree?
So Larry was my first boss in Washington at the National Economic Council. I think the world of I think he's right to be worried about inflation, right to be worried about a risk. I think Treasury yields, especially of the 10-year tenor and beyond, are simply moving higher. And I'm not smart enough to know in the next year whether it's going to be at 3%. but you wouldn't want to be long. You wouldn't want to be owning a bunch of these sorts of treasuries with this kind of policy. And
yeah,
so I believe the
more.
Trajectory for yields are going higher, which will make it even harder for our government to pay for these new expenses they've had. So I'll end with a final comment. Where will they end up? Where will they find a buyer of these new securities? I worry the answer will be the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Well, that's Kevin Warsh, who's, as I said, a former member of the Federal Reserve Board, one of the smartest guys on monetary policy in the world. Kevin, thanks so much for joining some of your weekend with us. Have a happy Easter and hope to have you on again soon.
Great. Thank you, guys. Sure appreciate it. Happy Easter to everyone.
Take care. Bye-bye. We'll be right back. You're listening to More Money on WABC.
This is More Money with economist Steve Moore. Now, Steve Moore.
Hi, folks. This is Steve Moore. You're listening to More Money. Thank you for joining some of your Easter weekend with us. I am not necessarily the greatest host in the world, but I'm very proud of the fact that I get some of the greatest guests on. We just heard from Kevin Warsh, who is one of the superstars of our financial system, and I was fascinated with his discussion. Now I want to turn to some politics. I'm trying to figure out what's going on with Joe Biden. I thought we were going to get Lunch Bucket Joe. I thought we were going to have a moderate Democrat. That's certainly how he sold himself. But I don't see that so far. I see a pretty radical left-wing spend, borrow, tax, pro-government agenda. And the best person to discuss this with is Dick Morris. You all know Dick Morris. He was a advisor to Bill Clinton at the White House. He actually turned around the Clinton presidency. It's something I've always so much admired about Dick Morris. He is one of the top political consultants in the world. He advises political candidates, not just in the United States, but from every corner of the globe. And he is also with Newsmax and other news outlets. So, Dick Morris, thanks so much for taking some time to join us.
Good. I'll also reveal, which I had not during the election, that I was heavily involved with President Trump. I spoke to him almost every day during the campaign. I kept it secret, but at his request, but had a lot of fun and gnashing my teeth over the outcome.
Yes, so I'm with you on that. By the way, I'm so glad to hear that you advised Trump. So let's get right into this. I'm very, very nervous about what's going on with our country, Dick. I did think we were going to get a more moderate centrist Democrat. I'm actually a big I love what Bill Clinton did with the economy, especially when you advised him to triangulate, move to the middle. I'm not seeing that from Biden. I'm seeing a very left-wing agenda.
Well, I think you're seeing a puppet. I think the issue is who is the puppeteer. And I think that his moves are being run by Barack Obama, Susan Rice, David Floofy, and David Floofy, I forget his first name, and David Axelrod. I think that the Obama administration has taken over the Biden administration. There's a very revealing interview with Obama that I saw a few weeks ago where he said, where they said, how would you like to be a kingmaker, not a king? And he said, well, it might be nice to be able to program the moves to be made without actually having to do them yourself. And I think that's what's going
on
now. Yes, I do. I think that because when you look at the people around him, the only ones who are smart enough to do what they're doing now is that crowd. But let me spend a moment. We spoke earlier by phone, Stephen, and let's just let them in on some of the things we talked about. I think that the infrastructure package is designed ultimately to force all American workers into a corporatist structure controlled by the government. Mm-hmm. I think that the first step in that is the infrastructure package, which creates this gigantic carrot that no contractor can resist and says, if you want to be part of the $2 trillion, and as you've taught me, Stephen, we have only $40 trillion in fixed assets in the United States. So $2 trillion is a big portion of that. If you want to be part of that, you got to form a union because all of the contracts for infrastructure, for new pipes, for new charging stations, for airports, for internet connectivity, all of that is going to be under Davis-Bacon, which requires that you have a union. And it will force contractors of all sorts to make their shops union shops.
Let me just interrupt you right there, because it's a great point, and I just want to add something, which is that also a big part of the Biden agenda is to override state right to work laws in 27 states. So that would be the biggest, that would force millions and millions of American workers to join a union against their will. So this is a very, very, and look, I'm not against unions, but I am against forcing people to be in unions.
Yep. So that's all in the PRO Act, P-R-O, which stands for something like people being represented in unions or something. And it's a bill that has been introduced and is on track to pass, to be pushed by the Democrats.
It passed the House already, did it not? I think it passed the House.
Yes,
it's now
did.
In the Senate. Yeah,
it did. And the Biden's people said, in fact, Biden himself said on Friday that he was going to put it in as an amendment to the infrastructure bill. And his hope is that the infrastructure bill is treated under the Byrd rule as a fiscal measure and bars a filibuster. The Senate parliamentarian may rule against him like she did on including the minimum wage in the stimulus package.
Yes.
But if not, this is definitely going to pass.
Yeah.
And the bill number one overrides state right to work laws, as you say, all over the country. But number two and three and four are the most deadly most of it. Two is that it eliminates and prohibits independent contractors, consultants, and freelancers.
Yep.
Basically,
anyway,
nobody
that includes,
in America
just,
will
again,
be
able to. Let me just point out, you're exactly right. And that would include, for example, Uber drivers or people who are independent contractors in the gig economy, which would just have a devastating impact on a lot of these technology companies.
I don't know what your arrangement with ABC is, but probably include you, because unless you're a paid employee of the company.
Are you saying I might have to join a union?
you might. But what you have to do right now is stop, close up your shop and become an employee of ABC. And if they're not your only client, become an employee of every client you have. I have five clients.
By the way, this sounds like a kind of partnership between big government and big labor and big business. And I think it's going to squash the little guy.
Of course, that's the goal of it. It's corporatist. And and I think that it's, but the point is that everybody who works for themselves would no longer be able to. And anybody who hired them as a consultant or a freelancer or a contractor would be subject to massive penalties. This is law now in California. It's called AB5. And it's had a devastating effect on the freelance and contractor economy in California. But that's only what
voters remember, Dick, that the voters in California overrode that by a wide, in liberal California, even the voters said, we don't want this. We want to allow the gig economy to move forward. We want to allow these drivers to be independent and not have to join unions. So I believe that when they took it to the voters and not the politicians, people were against this move.
Right. But that amendment, which was passed, is very limited in scope. It exempts Uber and Lyft and a couple of others. But the broad prohibition against
working
for yourself continues. And even the Uber and Lyft are not exempted from the PRO Act nationally. So the first step is you got to go on the payroll, which means they have to withhold taxes, FICA, workers' comp, unemployment insurance, family leave, health insurance, all of that stuff, all those mandates carry with it. And in many cases, you can't get a job at the comparable level that you had as a consultant, because when you have to fit into a corporate pay structure, you don't necessarily find a niche that's the same as you had as a contractor. So that's the first step is to get the stimulus package goodies, you got to have a union. The second step is if you're an independent contractor, you got to fold up shop and join a company.
Right.
The third step is that if there is no union in the company you join, it can be jammed down your throat without your voting on it.
Now,
the way you set up a union is that you ask a majority of the workers have to sign cards, check off cards, that say, I want a union election. And if they do, then an NLRB holds an election. The PRO Act eliminates the election. It says that the act of checking off some cards by a majority of the workers is sufficient unto itself, and that a union then is formed. So the problem is that when you check off a card, you bought, yeah. your shop steward is watching you, your coworker, your neighbors, yeah. your
sure.
friends.
Sure.
And indicative of the extent of coercion is that a third of the union elections requested by the employees go against the union. But this would no longer have that. There would be no election.
So what is it, Dick? What is the end game
here? Then you're forced into a union, and you're stuck. The end game here, I think the metaphor you have to look at, is that leftists, socialists, communists are very unhappy with gig economies or with very small businesses that are the heartbeat of American industry.
Yes.
Because you can't regulate them. At least they want them to be like in Japan, controlled by MITI, the government, or in Germany, controlled by the major companies and the major unions. And at worst, they want it to be collectivization like Stalin's Russia.
Right.
And that way they can control it. And I think their goal is to force everything into a corporate structure like Mussolini, where the government controls everything. The whole economy. And I think, and this is such a huge, huge power grab, totally transformed the American economy. So I think that when you look at the overview of Biden, he used COVID as an excuse to deform the electoral process.
Of course,
and
yes.
And he's using climate change as an excuse to deform the economic structure of this country.
That's right, yep. I couldn't agree more. So we got 2 minutes left. What do we do about this? You're the expert on politics. If you were advising, the Republican Party, and you may well be doing that.
Well,
what should Republicans be saying to stop this? It's almost like fascism, basically, what you're describing.
Yeah.
You know, where you have a partnership between big government and big labor and big business.
It is fascism. That's the corporatism is fascism. It's the definition of that. I think that the first thing we got to do is publicize this. People have to know about it.
Yes.
And nobody knows about it. I'll bet that nobody listening to your show now knows about it. Only reason I know about it is I have a TV show on Newsmax every weekend. Right. It's on Saturdays.
What time are you on? What time are you on Newsmax?
You can watch it. 7:30 tonight. 7:30 Saturday night. And 1 o'clock Sunday. And last week I did a show on the PRO Act, so I'm all up on it. But most people don't know. I think that the PRO Act might not pass because the parliamentarian may rule against it. And we may be able to filibuster it, and we may be able to stop it. But with the infrastructure package and the PRO package and all of this, if it does pass, it'll destroy the Democratic Party. Because everybody will have their lives completely screwed up by this. You're talking about 50 million people that would have to quit their jobs as self-employed people, close down their practices. For example, you couldn't have a Burger King franchise without being on the payroll of Burger King. Franchisees would have to.
You're depressing me, Dick, because the franchise model is a prototypical American model where somebody can put up a little bit of money, buy a franchise for a restaurant, and they want to take that away from us. I'm just so disgusted by this.
We are running out of time.
I want to.
It's going to screw up everybody's life, and they'll know that, and that's going to help us win these next two elections.
Yeah, but once these things are in place, they're very, very difficult to get rid of. That's why, folks, we have to rise up now in opposition to this. Dick, I'd love to have you on in the weeks to come. I mean, you are right on top of what's going on in Washington. It's a plot. It's a plot against the American free market system, and I'm very disturbed by it. All right, Dick Morris, thanks so much for joining us this week. I want to have you on in the weeks to come. And, folks, we'll take a few of your calls. 1-800-848-WABC. Are you concerned about this? Do you think we're spending too much money? You're listening to More Money on WABC.
This is More Money with economist Steve Moore. Now, Steve Moore.
Hello, you're listening to More Money. I'm Steve Moore. Thanks so much for joining us on this beautiful
Easter weekend, what I call Resurrection Weekend, because it has a religious connotation, but it also has an economic connotation because this economy is being resurrected thanks to the incredible vaccine. We're getting America back up all over the country. Even New York is starting to open. For goodness sakes, it should have happened 6-9 months ago, but finally, even New York schools and businesses and restaurants are opening. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. So I want to take your calls right now. I've got a bunch of people on the line, and so we're going to try to scramble through these as quickly as we can. We're going to start with Russell. Russell, what have you got for us?
Oh, hi, Steve. That was quick. Dick Morris shows how far you can go with a good high school education, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's a scary – he painted a very scary picture. What did you think?
Well, you know, 1099 was used on me to transfer a lot of responsibilities from the owners of businesses to workers. That was my experience. Just way back to driving a cab in the late 70s and 80s, and they made cab drivers start paying a lease, and we became independent contractors, even though, you know, the cab, nothing belonged to us. The schedule was set by someone else.
Right.
But it was interesting. I couldn't understand how he said corporatism is fascism, but then this was a union power grab. I mean, you know, Dick's got a great mind. He was stealing clubhouse elections with my father and Jerry Nadler on the Upper West Side in the 70s. I mean, he's really gone a long way. But
so, Russell, are you? How concerned are you as a guy? Did you say you drove a cab?
Well, I did, you know, for 10 years on and off. But I had to have two or three jobs all the time. I mean, I'm retired now. I'm 64. But throughout my life,
what do you think about? What do you think about forced unionism? Do you think people should be forced to join the unions?
You know, that's a complex question to me because I am a communist, like Dick Morris said. And I think unions, in theory, are a good thing. My experience with unions, they left me hanging quite often. I mean, I was in District 65 of the auto workers. I was in different unions. And when it came right down to it, I was a troublemaker, and they were glad to see me go, too. So in reality, unions have had a problem, but it's the leadership, like anything else. It's supervision that makes the whole difference.
Leadership.
If you don't have supervision, if you have bad leadership. I mean, I remember at the Stella Doro factory, real quick, there was a bakery. We could have gone in and occupied the bakery, but the leadership said, no, we don't want to endanger people's severance payments. Well, okay, that's short-term thinking. But, you know, can I ask you real quick, Steve, about this China thing that I wanted to bring up?
We got 1 more minute for this, so go ahead.
Real quick, you know, I'm very concerned about all this anti-Asian things that are going on. And I just wondered, China, everybody owes China money. Shouldn't China be shouldn't we require them to pay reparations, forgive the world's debt?
Yes.
The U.S. bonds specifically. If this does turn out to come from their ridiculous
lab. Good. Fantastic. Thanks for calling. I'm going to answer that question.
Pressure relief valve.
Yes.
Pressure relief. Thank you, Steve.
Yes. I agree with you, Russell. Look, China is the country that either willingly or just because of their incompetence imposed this virus on the world. It is the Chinese virus. It is the Wuhan virus. There is now some evidence that might have even been manufactured there in their laboratories. Should they pay a price? Absolutely. Absolutely. China should pay for what they have wrought on the world economy and especially on the U.S. Okay, let's get to our next question and caller. That's Steve.
Hi, Steve, and thanks for taking my call. Happy Easter to you.
Happy Easter to you, too.
Yes, the Biden administration is spending too much money. We can circle back to that. But I have a question for you. It relates to something you said earlier in the broadcast. You gave Joe Biden some credit for his administration of the vaccine program. Steve, please explain for my benefit, with all due respect, other than acting as an intermediary here, what is the Biden administration doing other than they got Operation Warp Speed, which had the infrastructure in place for the development and administration of the vaccine. He's just making sure that the states get it. And you see there's been bumps along the road since he took office. Yep. So, again, the question is, what has the Biden administration done to help the program along? I'm confused.
Okay. So great question, Steve. Thanks for calling. I'll answer that. Now, look, We're getting a nice, several million people now getting the vaccine every single day. You know, these are big numbers that we're getting, you know, as many as 2 to 3 million people a day. Now, I agree with you that Donald Trump set the table for this, and that I think will be one of his greatest legacies. 100 years from now, we'll be talking about how Donald Trump saved our country from this horrible vaccine. But I do think so far, I don't like most of what Joe Biden is doing. I am not a Joe Biden apologist, but I'm going to give him a little tip of the hat because I do like the way they've handled this vaccine distribution. It's run pretty smoothly, and this is not an easy thing to do, to get millions of vaccines to Americans every day. So a little kudos to Joe Biden. It's not something I do very much. But look, guys, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. When a president does something smart, I'm going to give them credit for it. When they do something dumb, I'm going to criticize them. So our lesson of the week, taxes are on our American businesses are no way to create jobs. The idea of raising our corporate tax rate, which when Trump took office was the highest in the world. We were exporting jobs and factories from the United States. Now we are under Trump, because we cut that top tax rate from 35 to 21%, one of the lower rates, we got jobs and businesses back in the United States. To reverse that policy and to raise not just our corporate tax rate, but folks, Biden would also tax our small businesses at 40%. 40% is too high. We should have a flat tax rate, like my good friend Steve Forbes talked about, of 18, 19, or 20%, not 40%, not 50, not 70% like AOC does. Let's have a 20% flat rate income tax. Everybody pays it. Zuckerberg pays it. Bloomberg pays it. Jeff Bezos pays it. LeBron James pays it. If they make $10 million, they're going to pay 20% of that. If they've got $1 billion, they're going to pay 20% of it. That's the best way to make Americans competitive. We should not have tax rates of 40, 50, 60, 70%, or you're going to kill our businesses. You're going to kill our jobs. That is my message for today, folks. I hope everyone has a very holy and happy and prosperous Easter. Good things are coming for this country if we just get government under control and just get government, frankly, out of the way. You've been listening to More Money on WABC. I'll be back next Saturday at 2 p.m. Have a great weekend, folks.